Good morning. I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright says the next president of the United States is going to face a number of key and critical problems. They include the spread of nuclear weapons, terrorism, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the crisis in Pakistan, Middle East rivalries, energy, and global warming. But first and foremost, she says, the next president is going to have to repair America's reputation and relationship with countries around the world. She blames the Bush administration for hurting the country's well-being and good name. She has argued that Iraq may go down in history as the country's greatest foreign policy disaster, worse than Vietnam. Madeleine Albright offers the next president some unsolicited advice in her new book called Memo to the President-elect, How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership. The book is written to whoever becomes the next president, even though Albright is an advisor to Hillary Clinton in her bid for the White House. And Madeleine Albright joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you back on the show. Good morning.
Great to be with you, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I just want to make sure that this book is written to whoever wins in 2008 November.
Absolutely. It's for either party or either sex, and I think that it's general, I think, in terms of advice. It's kind of a how-to book to the next president.
When you talk about America's tarnished reputation, what do you mean?
Well, according to so many surveys, and one actually sponsored by a Philadelphia-based organization, Pew, shows that our image everywhere is slipping and that many people in many countries consider us the most dangerous country in the world. And I think it's a great tragedy because it is essential for an American policymaker, somebody who's supposed to protect America's national interests, not to be loved abroad, but to be respected so that we can actually accomplish what we need to for the protection of the American people.
Do you think that criticism is deserved, undeserved?
Well, I think most of it's deserved, frankly, which makes me very sad because, and it revolves around basically Iraq. After 9/11, there was no question that the world was with us against those who fly into buildings and kill innocent people. But when President Bush tried to expand that to approval for dealing with the axis of evil, or then which was included Iran and North Korea and Iraq, and then also to support a war in Iraq, and other aspects of our policy in fighting terrorism, we began to lose supporters. And that's been the significant reason for that. And then very specifically, the war in Iraq, among the reasons that I say it's going to go down as the greatest disaster, is what it has done to our reputation, which can just be said in two words, Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo.
And those are, of course, so at least with Abu Ghraib, we've got those pictures of American soldiers or those working for the U.S. government degrading, torturing, abusing prisoners.
Well, absolutely. And most of us, you know, at least my generation, if we talk about America's reputation and what we've done, elicit words like Omaha Beach or the Marshall Plan or a variety of, or the Statue of Liberty. And now what you basically, the brand that America has with most of the world that's under 30 is they think Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, torture. And I find that just a more than troubling situation because I loved representing the United States. There was nothing greater than to sit behind that sign. And I think we are proud of our country, and it's very hard to see this kind of thing going on internationally.
But I wonder if there isn't history between Omaha Beach and Abu Ghraib that includes mistakes or relationships that the United States had with dictators, that the Cold War forced us to make choices that, in hindsight, also hurt the U.S. reputation.
I think that it's interesting you say that, Marty, because I think that people understood what was going on in the Cold War, that there were really two camps, the good guys and the bad guys, and we were the good guys, and that there was a certain amount of pragmatism in dealing with people that you might not want to be associated with. But mostly people understood that we were fighting a terrible system. There were struggles in the world of the non-aligned, but it was interesting. In many ways, America's reputation was not hurt by the Cold War. there were different aspects of it as to whether how we dealt with some of the neutral countries. But on the whole, that's nothing like what's going on now.
But I wonder, I mean, even focusing on Central America and support for, you know, governments that had death squads, for instance, that there were not just pragmatic decisions, but decisions that ended up hurting the U.S. reputation in that part of the world.
I think I'm not saying that everything went perfectly well all these years, and I think there clearly were terrible mistakes. People have talked about those. But again, it's not a systematic thing that you see across the world. You know, people weren't doing attitude surveys, so it's a little hard to say. But I think that there is just a cumulative aspect about how we are viewed as generally supporting a number of, you know, lack of rule of law issues, that we see ourselves as an exceptional country, which I happen to believe, but that we ask that exceptions be made for us.
How can a president, any president who becomes the next president of the U.S., change the U.S. reputation? I mean, what's the first thing they should do to address that?
Well, I think one thing, Guantanamo Base needs to be closed. That's one of the issues. But also, I think just the subjects that need to be dealt with, fighting terrorism without creating more anti-Americanism, the breakdown of the nuclear nonproliferation system, giving democracy back its good name, dealing with the negative aspects of globalization, which can be translated into a growing gap between the rich and the poor, and all those issues to do with global warming and energy, just by virtue of what they are going to require a different style. And so I think the next American president has to make really clear that we want to cooperate with countries, that we believe in alliances, that we believe in various international groupings, and that we understand that while we will continue to have huge amount of power, that in order to function, we have to cooperate with others and understand their national interests in order to foster ours.
You write in the beginning of your book, addressing to this to the president-elect, whoever he or she will be, you must begin with the understanding that our right to lead is no longer widely accepted. We have lost moral legitimacy. If we fail to comprehend this, we will not know how to formulate a successful strategy. That we're not, I mean, we are, I guess, the world's superpower, but we are not viewed the way, I guess, a superpower or might have been looked at 10 or 20 years ago.
Well, we are not viewed as a force for good, which really troubles me. I believe in American power, and it has played an important part in my life, both in growing up and then as a practitioner. And I have believed in the goodness of American power. But what we're seeing is an extension of power that is questioned in a number of places. And I have no criticism of the American military, which, in fact, the contrary. I think they deserve our praise and gratitude. But the way that American power has been projected has damaged us in many, many ways. But it's another issue also, just the issues themselves, as I describe them, even if we continue to be the sole superpower, those can't be dealt with by power alone. They are issues that require a great deal of cooperation through a host of diplomatic means, negotiation. I teach a course, Marty, on the national security toolbox. I say foreign policy is just trying to get some country to do what you want. So what are the tools you have? And what has happened is President Bush's team has not only been unilateral in using one tool, primarily military, but unidimensional, paying attention to only one part of the world.
I wonder, I don't even know if this is a worthwhile exercise, but taking the Bush administration at its word, the idea of bringing democracy to the Middle East, have you run the scenario that, you know, if there had been, let's say, 500,000 troops, as Shinseki suggested, if we had controlled the looting in Baghdad after the fall of the government, if we hadn't fired, you know, members of the Ba'athist Party and gotten rid of all the military, do you think we would be dealing with a different situation here? I realize that's all conjecture, a bunch of ifs, but have you thought about that?
You know, one of the things I always say is the ultimate hypothetical, if my grandmother had wheels, she'd be a bicycle. I mean,
so
there are lots of hypotheticals there. I think that there are various parts of all those, if they had happened, And there still would be question. I am chairman of the board of an organization called the National Democratic Institute that promotes democracy. I think we were in Iraq for a while, and I think we did find that there were people who wanted to participate in their governments and local elections and take part. I think that if, in fact, maybe things had gone differently, and if there had been an internal overthrowing of Saddam Hussein, then some of these things might have happened. But I think a lot of things were destroyed, literally, by not understanding the Sunni-Shia breakdown. And then people did go out and vote, and the Purple Fingers, President Bush talked about that again in his State of the Union message. But there were so many divisive aspects about the Baathists and the whole region. It would be very nice if all your ifs were
sure.
were real. And I don't put down anybody. I have always believed in democracy for the world in various countries because I think we're all the same. People want to make decisions about their own lives. But democracy is a process. It is not an event. And it requires a sense of security. And then a point that I've made over and over again, democracy has to deliver. You can have an initial election, but if there are not reforms, if there's not an economic basis to what's happening, because people want to vote and eat. And so that's an additional aspect about the democracy process.
Why do you think the Bush administration invaded Iraq?
I don't know. I mean, I have read every book. I have read every explanation. I think there are those who think that, the president and the team, Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld and the vice president kept adding various layers of why we had invaded weapons of mass destruction, then democracy, and a number of different aspects. And I don't think that we have a clear answer as to why.
What should be done next? And obviously, whoever becomes the next president, they're going to have to deal with Iraq, such as it is a year from now.
I think that it will. I'd be very surprised if it weren't on the table when the next president comes. And in fact, again, in the State of the Union message, the president made quite clear that the fight was going to go on. Some troops are going to come out over the summer. And if my math is right, he said around 20,000, which means about 110,000 are there. I think the troops have to come out in a systematic way because I agree, actually, with what Secretary Powell at one point said, the Pottery Barn rule. You broke it, you own it. And they're now, as a result of all the points you made, in terms of dismantling the military and all those different things, there is a vacuum in Iraq. And our military, as brave as they are the solution because they are providing security, but they're also the problem because they're like flypaper, attracting everybody who hates us. So I think there has to be a systematic way for the Iraqis to be trained up to take care of their own lives. We have to withdraw. We have to bring the equipment home. And the only reason for the surge, according to the administration, was in order to have a political solution. And that seems to be very slow, if at all. So that's going to have to be part of the next agenda.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Madeleine Albright, our guest today on the show. And she's written a new book. It's called Memo to the President-Elect, and it's subtitled How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership. She, of course, was Secretary of State in the Clinton administration. And we've got some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Today on the show, our guest is Madeleine Albright. She served in the Clinton administration as the first female Secretary of State. She also was ambassador to the United Nations since leaving government. She's been a professor at Georgetown University, and she's also a principal of the global strategy firm called the Albright Group. And we've been talking about her new book called Memo to the President-Elect. And we've got calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Linda from Princeton, New Jersey to join us. Linda, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Good morning, Dr. Albright.
Good morning, Linda.
I'll try to be as brief as
possible.
Yeah,
please do.
Mrs. Albright, this is not to single you out, but during the years of the economic and military sanctions against Iraq, I believe the opinion of the United States was well-formed in a very negative way by the Iraqi population who endured those brutal sanctions. And again, I'm not blaming you personally. I think you were part of a larger group that implemented them. But when we talk about trying to change our tarnished image, part of the problem, the way we're seen, is that's such a decadent viewpoint to take. Considering the suffering that was endured, we should be speaking about how to help the people who were victims of our misguided or perhaps deliberate policy that caused such horror in people's lives.
Well, Linda, you know, let me take
Could
your
you
point.
Talk about yeah. that issue?
No, I appreciate the call to Radio
well,
Times.
Well, thank you. Let me explain what happened. The sanctions came as a result of the fact that Saddam Hussein had invaded another country. He invaded Kuwait. He trashed it. Before that, he'd been involved in a war with Iran where hundreds of thousands of people died and he had gassed his own people. When we came into office, the peace agreements as a result of the Gulf War were translated into the sanctions resolutions. And we tried very hard, and I think there's been a real misunderstanding. The sanctions resolutions never affected sending in food and medicine. And the reason that it took so long to send in food and medicine was Saddam Hussein would not allow it to come in order to be distributed to the ordinary people and not as cronies. And it was something that we worked on very hard. Unfortunately, it then became translated into something that didn't work either, was the Oil for Food program. But the bottom line was how to get food into Iraq. So I blame Saddam Hussein. I do think that there obviously was a negative impression of the U.S., some because of the information policies of Saddam Hussein. But I think we have to remember how this started. Saddam Hussein invaded another country. And the real problem is generally how the U.S. can help its image. I am not saying that the image became deteriorated only under this Bush administration. We have had issues before, and there are many things that I wish we had done differently, but I do think that the major problems with the U.S. image come as a result of the actions of the Bush administration.
Well, I know critics of the Clinton administration and of the sanctions policy have talked about the fact that this, I believe it was according to UNICEF, something like 500,000 children either were suffering or died under the sanctions. And you're quoted as saying that the Iraq sanctions were worth the price, which, you know, putting those two things together sounds cold and calculating.
Well, and the bottom line is I don't know whether the UNICEF figures are correct or not, but what happened was I was interviewed on 60 Minutes by Leslie Stahl, presented with a bunch of photographs that I actually did not believe. But the bottom line is it's the stupidest statement I ever made.
Really?
I have now apologized for it and admitted it was stupid more than I think any other public official has ever said. But for some reason, people refuse to understand that, in fact, there never was an embargo on food and medicine, and the person to blame for the death of the Iraqi children is Saddam Hussein.
I wonder, looking ahead, and you talk about sanctions in your book, and in terms of, I guess, a toolbox of things that a president can do, sanctions is one of those tools, I'm assuming. But do sanctions really have the intended effects that their supporters believe they do?
No, I tell you the problem, Marty, is, as I said, a president gets into office and opens this toolbox, and there are not a lot of tools in it. There is diplomacy, which is the standard way countries talk to each other. There are the economic tools, sticks and carrots, sanctions, embargoes, and then trade and aid on the carrot side. And then use of force, either the threat of it, limited force or full force, law enforcement, and intelligence used as a tool. That's it. Diplomacy often takes a long time and requires the fact of talking to another country. The use of force is the hardest thing of all, or should be the hardest thing. So what happens is people pick up the economic tool. Hmm. We have learned a lot about sanctions, and I think mostly as a result of the effect of sanctions on Iraq, the people of Iraq, or their effect on the people of Haiti or whatever country that we have done full sanctions on. So I think the policy has changed a lot. It's something that we began to do at the end of the Clinton administration, which we call smart sanctions, that are directed only at the leaders of the country and their cronies, that affect their bank accounts or their desire to travel. And so they are deliberately done in a way that do not focus on the people. But again, what I find interesting is how people get something in their head and refuse to listen to the facts, which is that even when there are full sanctions, they do not apply to food and medicine.
Let me get Wendell from Kennett Square to join us. Wendell, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, first of all, I think you have a great program. I listen to it frequently, and
great.
I have great respect for Secretary Albright. But one comment that the Secretary made at the beginning of the show was that the words Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo mm-hmm. are what that represents is what is turning the world against the United States. And my feeling is that it's much longer standing than that, and is primarily due to the fact that we spend so much militarily. I mean, our budget is really out of sight, and also we essentially occupy other countries since World War II, being Okinawa, Korea, et cetera, and have an enormous presence in Europe. And I think that's really what turns people off, and it's been a long-standing issue, obviously, not just through the Bush administration, but for many decades. And I'd like her to comment on
sure.
that.
Sure. No, Wendell, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Sure. Madeline,
yeah.
Albright, go ahead.
Well, I disagree. Let me just say, I think that Vietnam was a very bad blotch on American policy. Questions about why we were doing that. In terms of the countries that you mentioned, those are countries where we have had agreements and the countries have been very happy to have our troops there, especially in Germany and South Korea. There was a certain question for time. But on the whole, these are countries that have welcomed our troops, especially during the Cold War. And they were part in Europe, the NATO alliance. And in fact, there are lots of questions about why we would want to leave even at this point. I am not defending everything that U.S. policy has ever done, but I have to tell you my own personal history, which is that I was born in Czechoslovakia. And when the United States is not involved, as it wasn't in Munich, for instance, because that was an agreement that the Germans made with the British, French, and Italians, terrible things happened. When the United States came into World War II, everything changed. When the United States decided, as a result of agreements, to let the Red Army liberate Central and Eastern Europe, terrible things happened. I believe in the goodness of American power and the necessity of engaging America. And we have so many other ways to show what we should be doing. And, you know, whether one reads it in the Bible or Batman, I believe to whom much is given, much is expected. And so I hope that the United States does not take the lessons of what has happened in Iraq and decide that we should just turn inward and worry about ourselves. America's reputation has been damaged. I believe it is primarily damaged by the activities of the last 7 years, but clearly not every aspect of American policy has always been perfect.
Wendell, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And that's Madeleine Albright, our guest today in Radio Times, former U.S. Secretary of State, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. She's written several books, and she's got a new one. It's titled Memo to the President-Elect, How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership. We got a full bank of calls here. Let me, though, quote something that you wrote recently in the Washington Post. You begin with this sentence: I believe the most precious gift the next president could bestow upon America is an end to the politics of fear. Fear of what? Terrorism?
Well, what's happened is because terrorism, 9/11 was a terrible event. There's no question about it. But I think that we cannot operate in this atmosphere of fear, because fear of terrorists has all of a sudden put us in a position where we're supposed to be afraid of asking questions and afraid not trusting anybody in our own country, and kind of a sense that it's all right to limit civil liberties. It's one thing to stand in line at the airport, that's irritating, but to have our civil liberties taken away. And I think that what needs to happen is the next president has to challenge us and talk to us like grown-ups and give us a sense of confidence instead of the anxiety and playing on the fear factor. Because it's very easy to make people afraid. But I think we should say what Franklin Roosevelt said, which is the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Well, I remember growing up and hiding under my desk. You know, this was back in the 1950s and 1960s, the fear of nuclear annihilation. Do you think the Bush administration has used fear in order for the executive to maintain control over parts of the country?
Well, it seems that way. I mean, I think that there is this kind of sense that, you know, we have to wiretap, we have to you know, one of the things that was out there, because I have been doing books, is that the federal government wanted to know what kind of books people check out and what kind of books they buy and, you know, things that don't work for me in the 21st century. And I think that we can have a healthy respect for fear. I mean, we weren't afraid of Hitler enough, but the bottom line is we can't run our lives all the time by being terrified.
What then do you think, you talk about this in the book, and it sounds almost like hearts and minds, but looking at the problem of terrorism, if not fearing it, I mean, what would be a better approach to dealing with terrorism?
Well, I think we have to understand who the terrorists are. And, you know, if somebody says they want to kill us, we should take that very seriously. But we have identified it with Islam generally, which is ridiculous because it means that people don't understand the Muslim religion. And that what we also, by calling it the war on terror, we have made warriors out of those who are against us when, in fact, they have no program. The only thing that they tell their people is, you know, in the end, they have posthumous recognition on their website. And the bottom line is, I was told, actually, when we were in office, it was probably better not to talk about Osama bin Laden all the time.
Is that right?
Because, you know, it just gives more notoriety and creates this kind of mythical reputation. And the Al-Qaeda has no economic program. It has nothing. And so we need to isolate the Al-Qaeda and try to make sure that there are not situations where Al-Qaeda can go and recruit, which goes to my point about the gap between the rich and the poor. Mm-hmm. I do not think there's a direct line between poverty and terrorism. But there are people who've been marginalized by their societies who also feel disenfranchised or just not are victims. And so then they become a very friendly environment for those who want to recruit people who hate us.
Well, that gets us to a discussion about Pakistan. And again, reading your book and what others have said about Pakistan, we've got a country with nuclear weapons. It's a country with a military dictatorship. I mean, a military leader that took over the country. The assassination of Benazir Bhutto. We've got terrorism, Al-Qaeda, problems with Iraq. Is this, do you think, if there's a part of the world that will concern the next president, do you think this is the place around
the
world?
Well, definitely. I'd say that it has all the elements of what gives you an international migraine. I mean, plus its location geographically in terms of what we need to deal with the issues in Afghanistan. So, yes, I think it is going to be of grave concern. And again, the events happened so rapidly there. It was one of the hardest parts of my book. The second part, which deals with issues, is to keep up with them. But Pakistan, we kept changing until the last minute, and it still didn't have Benazir Bhutto's assassination. So I think that situation is very likely to be very fluid and difficult for us to handle.
Do you think the United States should still maintain its relationship, its alliance with Musharraf?
Well, I think that from my perspective, I think that we have to see what happens in these elections. But it strikes me that he's in a very weak position and that the tragedy of Benazir Bhutto's assassination is that she really, I think, had the capability of bringing a coalition of democratic forces in some way to run the government. The question is what happens in the elections if, in fact, there is some coalition that elects the government. I think that Musharraf will probably have less and less power if the elections are free and fair. If they're not, and they're rigged, and then he decides to, again, fiddle with the laws and the Constitution, then we're going to be in a very tough spot. Otherwise, I think we're in better shape trying to support whatever government comes into place. The problem, Marty, is that we can't just abandon Pakistan. It is a very important geographically located country for us. And the very interesting part is that I think Musharraf actually had a coup against the rule of law.
When he went after the judges.
You know, there are not a lot of countries where you see lawyers with ties demonstrating. They have a functional middle class. They have a lot of poverty, but they do have a middle class and what we call a civil society. And so there are elements to build on. And what America should be focusing on is providing money for education so that people don't go to the madrasas, and then democratic infrastructure.
And just moving next door to Afghanistan, where we see, according to reports, a resurgent Taliban. There are now more attacks, suicide bombers, which was unheard of a couple of years ago. What do you think should be done about that country?
Well, I think that, again, it is one of those things. If President Bush hadn't taken his eye off the ball in Afghanistan, I fully supported what he did after 9/11. But then, for whatever reason, as we said earlier, the attention switched to Iraq. There was no connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. Now there's al-Qaeda in Iraq. But the Taliban are not only resurging, but they are making they're getting profits out of the poppy crop of the which creates opium, and are able to rearm themselves. President Karzai is a very fine man, mm-hmm. but doesn't control the whole country. And what is important there is that it's a NATO operation. The United States is having to send more Marines in there. I think that what has to happen, and the next president really has to focus on how to motivate and how to really strengthen NATO. And this is one of the big issues as to the relevance of NATO doing what we call out-of-area operations. So it's going to go on a while. I'm very concerned about it.
But and we're almost up in a break here, but you see Afghanistan as a test for these kinds of cooperative arrangements like NATO?
And the problem with it at the moment is that a lot of the NATO allies have kind of different mandates, rules of engagement, which make it very difficult for the commander there. But I think it is a test for NATO.
We'll take that very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We'll actually get some more callers into the conversation as well. Talking with Madeleine Albright today on the show, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, former Secretary of State, the first woman to hold that job. She's also the author of several books, and she's got a new one called Memo to the President-Elect, and it's subtitled How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership. We got a full bank of calls. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Madeleine Albright today, Madam Secretary, talking about foreign policy and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We've got Clarence from Philadelphia joining us. Clarence, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hey, Marty, good show. Madam Albright, good morning.
Hi,
I guess my comment would be, first of all, I don't believe it's rocket science, you know, member to the president. I think with Madam Albright and was in the administration, what they did was they kept the Palestinian and the Israeli talking. Bush administration, when he walked in, immediately decided he wasn't going to do that. Not only did he take his eye off the ball, but he wasn't going to play. And in my opinion, for the next president, they'll just have to get that process rolling because last night, I believe, in his State of the Union address, he indicated he wanted to define a Palestinian state by the end of the year, which I don't know, Madam Albright, if you think that's realistic or not. But
well, let's find out. Clarence, thanks for the call.
Well, thank you. I agree with you. Part of the problem was that they were not interested in doing what President Clinton had done, is spend so much time on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. I'm very glad that President Bush has finally went there. There was this famous roadmap that they talked about. They never took it out of the glove compartment. They never got going. But he now has been there. There's this Annapolis process, and he has said that he wants an agreement by the end of the year. I hope the next president has the opportunity to implement it. But I think it's very difficult. And Every day there's some stories out of the region that indicate the difficulty. Gaza, which was turned over to the Palestinians, was taken over by Hamas, and now Israel had cut off fuel and food, and so they breached the wall, right, which is interesting
into
because
Egypt.
It means that it can be done, and flowed into Egypt. So there are those issues. I think the only way this can be resolved is for very intensive talks that the U.S. really participates in. We can't make choices for them, but we can bring parties together. And I think it just takes a lot more work and interest than this administration has shown on it.
Should they sit down with Hamas? I mean, they do represent the people of Gaza. There was an election.
Well, I think what should have happened is Hamas, there should be some kind of an entry fee for parties to run in elections, one of which should be to give up violence as a tool. And the U.S. kept pressing for these elections, but that entry fee wasn't there. We can't talk to Hamas. Hamas is down as a terrorist organization. But the hope is that there would be some aspects, people in Hamas who would split away from just the way the Irish divided the IRA and Sinn Féin, so that there was a political arm that gave up violence. There is an Palestinian Authority with Mahmoud Abbas, who I think is very willing. I met with him in December and with Prime Minister Olmert, who really want this to move forward. They are, however, both of them, fairly weak leaders.
Mm-hmm.
The question is whether sometimes weak leaders can get together and, in fact, push something through because they know that they already have a lot of difficult issues out there.
Well, that's interesting. One of the things you say in your book, and this is talking about the Middle East and Palestinian-Israeli conflict, you say how you fail matters. And of course, the Clinton administration had a number of these meetings. There was a failure in that there wasn't the ability to create these two side-by-side countries. But why how you fail? Why does that matter?
Well, because it means whether you decide it's all over. I mean, I think that the thing, in some ways, you know, after Camp David, we worked very hard on Camp David, and then it was picked up again, and President Clinton put down some new parameters. And I can't say I'm overly hopeful in my mm-hmm. book about this issue, but I say it's like a merry-go-round, but it is important to get on it and be, because what we have seen is that fewer killings take place when there are discussions about a peace process. It gives people hope. There are real aspects of the agreement that can be brought into place, and it's when you totally ignore it that the worst things happen.
But even if agreements fail, does that raise expectations and then people become even more disappointed? But you're saying that just the fact that people are talking
makes
says
a big difference.
Something to
and
the people.
And Prime Minister Rabin had a great statement. He said they had to deal with a peace process as if there were no terrorists and fight terrorists as if there were no peace process going on, the translation of which is you can't let suicide bombers or terrorists have a veto over whether a peace process goes on. It is very important to keep talking. And there are all kinds of images, you know, bicycles that you have to keep pedaling or treading water or whatever. I kind of ran out of them after a while. But I do think that it's important to keep talking.
And we've done a number of shows about this ongoing conflict. And everyone seems to say, at least the people we've talked to recently, is that everyone kind of knows what it's going to look like. It's going to look sort of like the 1967 borders, the settlements. Some of the settlements are going to have to be torn down. There will have to be some kind of reparations for Palestinians, and that's sort of the goal that everyone agrees on. The trick is getting there. Would you agree with that?
Yes. I mean, what President Clinton put down in December of 2000 were these kind of parameters that generally said there'd be a separate state, that there would be some a compensation of land for some of the major settlements that will not be dismantled. Some of them would have to be dismantled. The refugees, you know, Israel could make a decision about, like any country, which refugees it takes in, and the Palestinians would take the others, and there would be a way to deal with the holy places. The details are huge, though, because, for instance, in what President Bush has done, they're talking about having working groups. They can't agree on the names of the working groups. So is it the right of return working group, or is it a refugee working group, or even the numbers, which is one which is the first working committee, which is the sixth working committee, or however many they're going to have. So the details are truly the most difficult part.
Let me get back to our callers. We've got Olivia from Glenside. Olivia, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi,
hi there.
Thanks. I wondered if, what your opinion is of the world leaders and how they, whether they look at the U.S. at administration separately from the American people, and if we elect somebody with a very different approach and maybe more of a diplomat, that we can repair our relationships with other leaders fairly quickly.
Olivia, thanks for the call.
Yes, and Olivia, I do think so. I think that what all these attitude surveys show is that the American people are liked, and that they understand us and they welcome us, and you know, they like our music and our technology. I think they were a little surprised about the re-election of President Bush. How come we as American people did that? But on the whole, I think American people are liked, and I think it will be possible for a new and different kind of president. But I think the thing that we all have to keep in mind is we're in a pretty bad place on a whole host of issues. And so the point that I make in my book is that this is going to be a very hard presidency. I think there'll be a short honeymoon, but there are a lot of issues out there where other countries have a stake in them, where their national interest is not the same as ours, or we haven't listened to their national interest. There are new powers rising, China and India. Russia has kind of resurfaced. The Europeans have a very large market. So these are all things that the next president has to take into consideration. But believe me, the most important thing is to have a different kind of a president.
Well, I mean, it should be said that you are supporting Hillary Rodham Clinton.
I am,
and you
yes.
are advising her. Why do you think she would be the best president?
Well, I think that she, because I do think this is going to be a hard presidency, because I think she, first of all, she has really met and knows a lot of world leaders. And I think that that personal relationship and the amount of time she's spent with them and how she can deal with them is important. I think also she has a very good understanding of the issues. She's worked on a lot of them. She knows how executive legislative relations work, and I just think she has the best experience. I obviously am supporting Democrats, and I think that having a different president is going to be very important.
Well, as you know, Barack Obama got the endorsement of Teddy Kennedy, of Caroline Kennedy as well. You write about President Kennedy in your book and the kind of hopefulness that he represented. Do you see the support for Barack Obama as connected to President John F. Kennedy?
You know, I'm not a political
pundit. No, I know you're not.
And I think that, you know, there are a lot of different people supporting the candidates. I think the important part is to look at the candidates. And I have taken a vow. I am not criticizing anybody else who is running. I, from my own perspective of knowing Hillary Clinton and then looking at what the issues are, I think she's the person that could do the job. But as you said earlier, this book is for mm-hmm. anybody who becomes president.
Well, you also have some advice, and this goes back to creating cabinets, a president's relationship with Congress, how you, I guess, hire for your cabinets, how you deal with dissension or disagreement within an administration. Speak to that, and then we'll get back to our callers.
Well, I think what's very important is to pull together a team. But a little bit the way President Lincoln had a team of rivals, it's very important for a president to feel comfortable with different voices in the cabinet or in the decision-making circle, and to really encourage people to disagree with each other and to be comfortable hearing all those different opinions, to have a president who's curious and who... So I have been saying that I want to see a confident president mm-hmm. rather than somebody who is certain, because as a human being, it is impossible to have perfect certainty. And a certain president often doesn't know what he doesn't know. So a confident president. And the other part, though, I think that we have to see that our government is based on the relationship of the executive and legislative branch, the judicial branch also, and that a lot of it depends on exchanging information, on working as a team. I actually think the next president is going to have some, because I believe the Democrats will win, some Republicans in the cabinet in some way. And so there really is a way of trying to knit the country back together and understanding the importance of public opinion. But more than anything, because I've seen it, is how important it is to have a president who respects people's diverse ideas and in fact, enjoys hearing different ideas out there.
When you use the word certain, saying that certainty has its risks because you don't know what you don't know, are you thinking about President Bush, who is, you know, people's praise him for his resoluteness? I mean,
well,
that seems to be a quality.
Yes, frankly, I think that part of the issue, and this goes back to one of the earlier discussions we were having, it is very hard to tell how the decision-making process to go into Iraq worked. And there are some books that tell us that there actually weren't meetings that would say, now we are, you know, what do you think? Are we really going to war? And I think there's a difference between resoluteness. I believe that my vision of a president is somebody who listens to all these ideas, then makes up his or her mind, and knows what basic principles are, but is not afraid of that open discussion.
Let me get back to our callers. It looks like we've got Julia from Spring Lake, New Jersey. Hi, Julia. Go ahead. You're Radio Times.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Girl, right. It's such an honor. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi, Julia.
You couldn't have just said something more than what I was just about to ask, comment on. This idea of respecting diverse ideas. I'm a high school teacher, and the high school that I work in my cafeteria, you would never know there's, you know, the conflict in the world. The students are from Asia and the Middle East and Europe and South America, and the way they all sit side by side, I mean, it's wonderful. This your idea of engaging America, and particularly America's youth, and that it's very necessary for the next president to do so. What advice do you have, and what for you know, trying to get the youth involved in politics? Because I can tell you, I had to write on the board the other day. It's necessary, you know, how to register to vote, and by a certain date. And they kind of all had a look on their face that, and these are very, you know, academic students. And,
sure. Julia, let me take your comment and get a
response.
I think
it's very important, and I think, you know, when I was growing up, you didn't get to vote till you were 21, so I'm very happy to see the 18-year-old vote. But actually, Julia, it's people like you, the teachers, that have to, you know, we don't seem to teach civics and things like that anymore. I think it's absolutely essential, and what I love about this campaign season is that there are more young people involved. I teach at a university level, and there seems to be much more excitement about the election. But we have not done enough talking about that it's a privilege to vote and a responsibility and to get information, which comes to the problem of where kids get their information. Mm-hmm. The bloggers or TV shows. But I think that the real issue is that they need to know that their participation is what makes it work. And so not just because you call, but high school teachers have a huge role to play in this in order to motivate the youth. And then what I find interesting is young people across the world actually get along. And there are all kinds of wonderful exchange programs, some of which have been limited because of the fear factor. But I do think that makes a difference.
Julia, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And you have famously said that there's a special place in hell for women that don't help other women. Was there a woman that helped you?
Well, actually, not a lot, because there were not really women role models. And, you know, everybody talks about Eleanor Roosevelt, but she was long gone by the time. I went to a women's college. I went to Wellesley. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of fabulous professors there, and that made a difference, and aside from the fact that all the women had leadership roles. But what I've been talking about has a lot to do with the workplace and people's careers, and that because there are so few slots at the top for women, there sometimes becomes a little bit of a queen bee complex and thinking, you know, if there's only one spot, why should I nurture somebody else? And so I have seen that it's very important when you climb the ladder of success not to push it away, and that it is better to be a woman that has support throughout the workplace or government or wherever. And so that's why I've been making that statement.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And Madeleine Albright has been our guest. Her book is titled Memo to the President-Elect, How We Can Restore America's Reputation and Leadership. She teaches now at Georgetown University, and she's also principal of the Albright Group, and that's a global strategy firm. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Find out more about the program, including podcasts. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.